Well, hello, welcome to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. So great to be with you all tonight. So we have a great show stacked up for you tonight. Later on, we're going to be talking with scientist Bill Andrews about curing aging. Would you like to live forever? I mean, what does that really mean? To Bill Andrews, it means living a healthy life past 1,000 years old. Is that for you? Does that appeal to you? Well, it does to Bill Andrews, and he is pushing the envelope. He wants to extend human longevity using regenerative medicine. So we're going to talk a lot about biohacking, future of medicine, and his motto is to live forever or die trying. Sounds like a great movie title. But first, we're going to be talking about the internet. So now, how much of the internet is censored? And if it is, then what organization is censoring it? Who is they, and what don't they want us to see? What if we could open source everything and allow the deep web, which is actually there, to surface? What would we see? And well, my guest tonight is Robert David Steele. He's an American activist, former CIA officer, and he is known for his promotion of open source intelligence. His latest book is called Open Source Everything. His motto is, the truth at any cost lowers all other costs. And he will be joining us right after the break. This is Lisa Gar. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. My guest tonight is a former CIA officer, and he is also an activist, Robert David Steele. He's written a book called Open Source Everything, about bringing the deep web of the internet to the surface. And he basically says that if we open source everything, then it makes the entire internet transparent, which in turn can drive innovation while eradicating corruption and waste. And I would love to find out more about this. Welcome to the show, Robert David Steele. Thanks for
Well, it's an honor to be with you. I guess person number 1,560.
Well, you're number one in my mind. So let's talk about this. Exactly what is open sourcing on the internet? What do you mean by that?
Well, there's an open source ecology, and I have to give credit to everybody that came before, particularly Richard Stallman and Linus Torvalds. They were the pioneers for open source and free software. What most people don't realize is that if you do just open source software alone, or if you do open data alone, then you're not going to get the full benefit. You have to go all in with open source everything. And I've produced a graphic that shows open source hardware, open source software, open networks, open spectrum, open cloud, open data, of course, open source intelligence. And then there's the technology, all the maker spaces, all the fabrication labs that are doing open farm technology. You've got the wonderful Global Village construction set. So open source ecology is about applying a mindset and a process that essentially eliminates patents. It eliminates trademarks. You still have Creative Commons licensing, which means that you're free to modify and repurpose and use something. But if money comes into play, then you have an obligation to get back to the originator. Now, here's the bottom line. Open source everything is the only approach to both information sharing and to engineering that is affordable, interoperable, and scalable. So it's a way to create a prosperous world at peace. It's a way to uplift humanity. It's a way to create infinite wealth for the 99%.
And by making everything transparent on the internet. So you're
Well, it's not just the internet. The internet is a fraction of what we know. And in fact, when you want to talk about waste, if you're eliminating agricultural waste or energy waste or health waste or military waste, it's about getting in touch with what are the true costs of everything, true cost economics. It's about doing holistic analytics and understanding the feedback loops. And essentially, it's a way of dealing with complexity. Transparency, I like a phrase that the Linux people like to say, if you put enough eyeballs on it, no bug is invisible. Well, if you put enough human minds on any problem, no corruption is invisible, no waste is invisible, you end up changing the game in a very significant way.
You don't think that it would overexpose us, that we would be over inundated? Well, basically, that's the point, isn't it? If you're over inundated with information, then it starts to denominalize what it is that is that we're inundated with, doesn't it?
You're raising a very important point. First off, I want to say that nothing about the open source world degrades anonymity, identity, privacy, or rights. In fact, open source software is the only software that is completely secure because it is completely transparent at the code level, and you don't have all of the proprietary bugs that are characteristic of Microsoft or IBM or Dell or Google or any of these other people.
So if there was a virus, it would be visible.
It's absolutely visible. And so open source software is actually vastly more reliable than any form of proprietary software. And anonymity can be provided within an open source context. Now, going back to information, you talked about the internet and making everything transparent. I like to point out to people that Google, by its own admission, only indexes 0.04 of the internet. The rest of the information is in what's called the deep web, which is not the same as the dark web, which is a mistake that Time magazine made a while ago. The deep web is all of the information that is not indexed by Google or Yandex or Baidu. Baidu's the Chinese Google.
Search engine. Mm-hmm.
Yandex is the Russian Google. And the reason Google has failed in both of those countries is because Google failed to be nuanced about language and cultural context. So let's take a typical activist organization that's producing these wonderful glossy PDFs. Those PDFs, by virtue of being down inside their web and often not having a persistent URL, are not being indexed, and they're also not subject to translation. One of the things I like about Google is its translation feature. So if you want millions and millions of people to be able to read what you're producing, you need to put it in full text online, not PDF.
Okay, so, all right, So could you actually view things like what the CIA is doing, what different types of terrorist organizations are putting up on the internet? You could actually view all of these things if it was open sourced. Is that correct?
Well, you can still view all of these things. We did back when I had a corporation. We identified, evaluated, translated, and reported on 396 terrorist, insurgent, and opposition websites. What I really want to make clear here is that open source is not just a software and a hardware, it's a way of approaching things. It's a way of sharing information. For example, the secret intelligence community today is primarily about collecting technical information. They don't actually process it. NSA processes less than 1% of what it collects. So the good news for your listeners is that NSA is not processing everything it collects about every American citizen.
Mm-hmm. That is good.
The bad news is that if you ever get elected senator or representative or mayor, they will find a way to inform you that they've got every email and every cell call you ever made in your lifetime.
Retroactively?
Yes.
Wow.
In other words, it's stored.
Everything, yes. Everything.
When you become important, they've got everything you've ever done.
Hmm. And even so, that means up until this moment, everything that we've ever done is accessible through the NSA.
I think they started, actually, in a lot of ways, I think we need to look at Google as an extension of the U.S. intelligence community. It was started with CIA money. It has clearly been engaged in some forms of covert operations overseas. It has clearly been used as a vehicle for moving money and influencing organizations that don't realize that they're actually dealing with what could be called an arm of the U.S. government.
Moving money? In what way?
Spending money on activist organizations in a way that I consider unhealthy.
Google supporting those?
Yes. In fact, we've just at Phi Beta Iota, we've just published, or maybe we're about to publish, I can't remember. There's an excellent new piece on Google may not be all that it appears to be. And I'm looking now to find it. But
That's your website where you do the reviews, right?
I curate Phi Beta Iota. And we have about 80 contributing editors, and one of them just posted. I mean, so much passes before my eyes, I have to tell you, frankly, I forget a lot of it.
See, now that's what I would think would happen if you open sourced everything. It would be so much information, Robert, that it would be inundating us. How would we know what's truth, what's not truth? I mean, does Google censor this for a reason? And if
well,
he didn't...
I'm glad you bring that up, because one of the things, Google has recently been sued by a locksmith, and the locksmith is suing Google because essentially Google's results these days are no longer reliable. You get what someone else has paid for you to see.
Mm-hmm.
That is a scary, scary thought.
But that's indicated by the advertisements, and it's in a shadowed box. And
well, yes and no. I think that all Google algorithms need to be subject to scrutiny. Just like Wall Street is doing fast trading, Google is doing fast algorithms. And we need Google's computational mathematics is out of this world. They are far, far ahead of so many people. But that also means that there's no oversight of Google. There's no understanding of how their algorithms are working. There's no quality control on those algorithms. And I think this locksmith will win his court case, because Google is clearly misrepresenting the profession of locksmiths, and it's putting search results up which are not consistent with who has been licensed and who has got past performance and so forth. Now, coming back to your concern about being overwhelmed, the human brain is what we use to deal with massive amounts of information. And I really love Jim Bamford's book, The Body of Secrets. It's about NSA, and it's about the $1 trillion that NSA has spent trying to build the ultimate computer. And the last sentence in Jim's book points out that one day NSA may finally succeed in building the ultimate computer, something that fits in your hand, that uses almost no power, and that can do petaflop calculations per second. And the last three words in Jim Bamford's book about NSA are the human brain. Where I think we have failed is to actually help people think about information and share information and do analysis. Clay Sharkey calls it cognitive surplus. Well, the U.S. government is not drawing on all of the people that it could be drawing on to make sense out of things. In fact, an article just came out today. Several studies have come out that say the U.S. government is owned and controlled by 42 billionaires. That's not a healthy thing for democracy.
Right. It, of course, it's powers in the hand of a few. But so you're saying basically we can be our own Google, that we need to have the power to search ourselves our own indexes as opposed to.
Yes. Yes. In fact, liquid democracy identifies people who are clearly at the top of their game. They're experts in any given area, such as agriculture. I mean, I'm starting to go vegan. I mean, I'm really starting to become a huge believer in eating well and using food, healthy food, as a way of avoiding disease and so forth. So I'm looking to people who are experts in vegan eating, and I rely on them to process all of the information about what's healthy food and what
right
properly.
Right.
And so essentially, I'm treating them as my vegan intelligence officers.
I see. Okay. But now, if you open source the internet, how do you avoid things like the garbage coming up about the which is already very prevalent on the internet, the porn sites, the gambling,
Yes.
How to build a bomb. I mean, all of that's already there, but it is.
You're absolutely right. In fact, The Onion just came out with a satire which says that 83% of web content is unfit for human consumption. That was just published today by one of our editors that goes by the name of Yoda.
Good point. Though you're right. It is.
The internet is largely a vehicle for sharing information. One of the problems that we have with the internet and that we have with information technology generally is that the tools for doing analysis are not there. In the 1980s, I was one of the people. There were others smarter than me, Diane Webb and Dennis McCormick in particular. They came up with a concept for computer-aided tools for the analysis of science and technology. And there were three levels of tools that still do not exist today in an integrated fashion. The first level was tools for ingesting information, for taking in audio and video, being able to take in foreign languages. There are 183 foreign languages that are very important to achieving an understanding of ground truth, of true cost economics around the world. And then there's a second level for detecting patterns, for detecting anomalies, for doing shared analysis, for seeking multinational points of view. One of the things the United States is really bad about is it doesn't ask foreigners what they think. CIA will only talk to U.S. citizens with clearances, okay, which is a very small number of people. There are roughly 1,400 Middle Eastern professors in the United States. CIA is talking to perhaps 14 of them. And even though CIA theoretically is talking to foreigners as clandestine agents, in fact, 90% of what CIA does is based on what foreign government intelligence agencies give it as handouts. So we got Afghanistan wrong in part because we were listening to Pakistan.
The wrong guys, yes. That weren't on the ground and weren't from the culture and weren't familiar with the history as, from being from the region as opposed to reading it in the book and papers.
That's exactly right. We don't have a sufficiency of open source experts in Afghanistan, nor do we have reliable clandestine human sources in Afghanistan. Or take ISIS as an example. This whole ISIS thing has caught us by surprise in part because CIA hasn't been doing its job. It doesn't have, and neither has the State Department. The State Department is locked up in its bunker embassies and doesn't get out to talk to people. And CIA is not recruiting clandestine human sources that are independent of local liaison. So the United States is actually, as a government, I did my second graduate thesis on this, they're actually operating on the basis of 2% of the relevant information for any given foreign situation.
So doesn't the government have access to this deep web? Doesn't the government have access to this information? So how are we told what is viewed? How is that decided? How is it decided what indexes and what's highest up on the indexes for our searches?
Let me tell you a story that kind of highlights not only how I became awakened, but the emptiness of the U.S. government. I was recruited back to the Marine Corps away from the CIA in 1988, and I was given responsibility as the senior civilian responsible for creating the Marine Corps intelligence activity. I had $20 million to spend. I spent it on a top secret system. I got access to all of NSA stuff, all of CIA stuff, and I had about 20 analysts. And over in one corner, in what used to be a cook's workstation, a glassed-in little room, we put a PC with access to the internet. Now, in 1988, the internet was basically something called the source. That was pre-Google. Inside of 2 weeks, my analysts were lining up for access to the internet. And I went to them. I said, "What are you doing? We've just paid $20 million for you people to have access to everything that the U.S. government knows." And they said, "Well, newsflash here. The U.S. government doesn't know anything about Burundi or Haiti or Somalia. Everything in the classified databases was about the Soviet Union and China and Libya and Iran and North Korea and Cuba." Okay? So the U.S. government is actually empty when it comes to deep understanding of third world countries and non-priority one issues. In fact, a study was done by Boyd Sutton, one of my former bosses and a man that I still hold in the very highest esteem. It was commissioned by George Tenet. It was called The Challenge of Global Coverage, and it concluded that there are over 150 countries and topics that the U.S. government simply doesn't understand, and that we should spend $10 million on each of those countries and topics. That was a budget of $1.5 billion a year. I continue to be a champion for an open source intelligence agency that would spend that $1.5 billion and that would do whole of government intelligence support. We don't do intelligence support to agriculture or energy or health.
Yeah, what about medicine? I mean, so say, for example, I'm deep in Thailand and I've created a stem cell that could grow a limb. And I take that information and I put it up on the internet. How do I know where if that's going to be censored or not, or taken down or not? That's basically the question that we're addressing. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with Robert David Steele and continue to find out how all of this applies to us at home. What are we not being shown about health, about agriculture, about unemployment? We'll be right back. This is Lisa Gar, listening to Coast AM. And we are talking about open sourcing everything with my guest, Robert David Steele. In his new book, he says, open sourcing can restore public agency. It takes away fear with transparency. It ends corruption and waste with the truth. It restores trust among all publics, both domestic and foreign. And he said it's the technical and moral foundation for a real collective. Interesting concept. And so basically we're going to find out more about how the truth at any cost lowers all costs. We need to get to the economic basis of all of this as well. We will be back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. My guest is Robert David Steele. Now he's an ex-CIA officer and also an activist. His promotion of open source intelligence is the basis of his latest book called Open Source Everything. So let's talk about open sourcing everything. I mean everything, Robert. What about the CDC? What about our most trusted CDC?
I'm so glad you asked that.
Let's go there.
Thinking about answering your question on the Thailand thing, and I mean, things are both censored. Wikipedia, for example, many of the pages have been hijacked by the pharmaceutical companies and big agriculture and so forth.
Give me an example.
The example that hits me the closest is just about anything having to do with drugs. I don't trust Wikipedia anywhere that money is involved. And an example that's very personal to me, I spent 5 days creating the open source intelligence page at Wikipedia. And I drew on over 400 international authorities whose presentations at my international conference I had funded. And I was absolutely stunned to have that page destroyed by a Wikipedia editor who informed me that because all of the links led back to OSS.net, which is where all of this information was archived, I was considered a self-promoter. So Wikipedia management, if you will, and I complained to Jimmy Wales directly, and he refused to do anything about it. Wikipedia is very high-handed about how it enforces rules, and they can make some very arbitrary decisions. I've also found...
It's very opinionated as well. I've looked up many different people where... I've interviewed them myself and spoken with them myself, and I look up their bios, and it's completely different from who they truly are.
You're absolutely right. And one of the problems is that you have several different classes of editor. And I'll give you the bottom line. In minor tourist stuff, Wikipedia is lots of fun. In serious stuff, I think Wikipedia is completely lacking in integrity, and therefore I don't use it for anything that's serious. Now, let me come back to your concerns about the U.S. government, whether it knows or does not know, and whether it lies. Let me just start with unemployment, and then we'll segue into Ebola. The actual unemployment rate in the United States of America today, according to shadowstats.com, is 22.4%.
Wow, that's high.
Yes, it is. And it's because shadowstats.com continues to count everybody who wants work but has been dropped from the workforce, can't find work, is not getting unemployment benefits, and so forth. In my own demographic, over 60, I think it's closer to 40%.
Mm-hmm.
College students, there are over 30 million college students with degrees who are living at home with their parents because they cannot find work. People simply don't understand.
But they're not included in the statistic because they weren't initially employed?
I'm not sure, because I have to rely on shadow staff. And this is a good example. Someone like me relies on others. I believe in relying on other people as your liquid democracy kind of proxy persons. And I absolutely rely on shadowstats.com. I rely on Charles Smith. I rely on Joseph Stiglitz. There are so many smart people out there that are experts in their field. One of the problems that we have is that the internet is just now starting to help people get control of information, get a grip on information, and challenge the government. The U.S. government very often does not know what it's talking about, and it is also very capable of lying to the public. Now, let's talk about Ebola and the CDC. Number one, when Ebola first became a threat, and we knew about the Ebola threat 10 or 15 months ago. I forget the exact number of months, but we knew about it. We chose not to take it seriously. And the one person who was willing to take it seriously, a Navy admiral, a lady, I forget her name, it might be Powell, she mysteriously disappeared. It was like she was shut up and run out of town. But CDC was telling the first responders and the nurses that they should use the N95 mask. The N95 mask is good to 0.3 microns. Ebola is a 0.08 micron threat, which means that the mask that the CDC was recommending was completely inappropriate. The CDC was also saying that Ebola couldn't survive outside the host. We now know that Ebola will survive outside the host under cold conditions, and it may mutate to where it survives outside under warm conditions. We now know that 21 days is not enough as a quarantine period. And they're arguing over the numbers, but in 1 out of 8 to 1 out of 20 cases, Ebola will survive for up to 40 days. Okay, so the quarantine period needs to be 40 days, not 21 days.
Wow, so all of these people that are being released could still very well be contaminated.
Well, at least 1 out of 8 of them, if not 1 out of 20. Again, I'm not an expert. I'm just saying that in this specific instance, CDC has not been a reliable authority, and neither is the NIH person. This guy that's been talking for the NIH has been a huge failure previously with respect to AIDS and HIV.
Now, how did you get this other information about the 45 days and about the N95 mask?
I have a number of contributing editors, and we have posted this at Phi Beta Iota. And the easiest URL for your viewers or your listeners to remember is robertdavidsteele.com. That leads to my personal bio page, which also leads to the Open Source Everything Manifesto home page. And so I'd be very glad to have your listeners use Phi Beta Iota and look up some of our contributing editors. If they just go to Phi Beta Iota and they look up Ebola, which is trending right now, they will find posts by Owl, who is a top expert that chooses to remain anonymous. They'll find posts by Berto Jungmann out of Europe. He was the number two guy for open source intelligence in the Dutch military intelligence service. So these people all come together, and through them you can go to others. So I have to say, in my experience, the U.S. government half the time doesn't know and the other half the time lies.
Well, now, didn't you say that the government, the U.S. government, is what is actually monitoring or censoring the internet? Did you say that or didn't you?
I'm not sure I said that. They're certainly monitoring the internet. They're certainly monitoring social media, which I think personally is a waste of time. One of the concerns that I have, there are 8 information tribes. Okay, there are 8 information networks, and I'll just list them in alphabetical order, because one of our tasks as a civil society is to get back in the power game. We posted Early this morning, Eric Liu has got a YouTube, 17 minutes and 19 seconds, entitled Why Ordinary People Need to Understand Power. This is one of the most impressive YouTubes I have personally ever watched. That's Eric Liu on Why Ordinary People Need to Understand Power. Now, part of the problem we have is that the citizenry is disengaged, but we also cannot rely on academia. Academia has become fragmented to the point that PhDs now are done on everything about nothing. We can't rely on the media. We have five major corporations, and the New York Times has been particularly bad. Some of the stories that the New York Times have spiked could have prevented the $4 trillion we've spent on Iraq. James Ridenson has written a wonderful book called Pay Any Price. And by the way, you haven't told your listeners, I'm the number one Amazon reviewer for nonfiction reading in 98 categories. And they can examine all of my reviews in each of those 98 categories at Phi Beta Iota using
you the definitely, review. Yes, you definitely do know how to review books. I did notice that.
It happened by accident. You know, I had...
Something
I had,
you do on the side?
Oh, no, I had two books that I had published on intelligence, Spies and Secrecy in an Open World, and then my second book was The New Craft of Intelligence, Personal, Public, and Political, and each of those books had 150 reviews in an annotated bibliography. So I had 300 reviews when Amazon first started this.
All right, let's stay focused here. Let's stay on we're talking about the government monitoring certain sources. So why ordinary people need to understand power? Why do they?
Well, I think they need to understand power because today the government doesn't represent the public. The government represents the 42 billionaires, including the Koch brothers, that are basically funding a Senate in which it doesn't matter whether it's the Republican or the Democratic Party that's in control of the Senate, because they are both serving the same masters, the 42 billionaires that funded and put them in power. In fact, one of the things I've learned is you only need one senator to put a hold on any legislation or to stop any government program from interfering with your business. So the name of the game for rich people is buy one senator and use that senator to basically create a toll booth in the government process.
Buy one, get one free, right? Basically. All right, so you actually have some experience in politics because you ran for president apparently back in 2012. Is that right? Did I understand that correctly?
This is true, and I tell the story of how I tested the boundaries of the two-party tyranny in an article in Reality Sandwich, and I also briefed this to the hackers on Planet Earth, where I've spoken since 1994. Here's what I really learned. I learned that there are 8 accredited political parties in the United States, 6 of which are completely blocked from power by the two-party tyranny. Constitution, Green, Libertarian, which is the third largest party, Reform, which accepted my candidacy for the presidential nomination, but I have to specify, I dropped out after 6 weeks. And then Natural Law and Socialist. And then, of course, you have the 40% of the U.S. public that now considers itself independent. All of these people are blocked from ballot access. Their votes are marginalized. And this is a very deliberate decision. I learned that 9 times the U.S. Congress has been asked to pass a law that mandates that all of the accredited parties should have access to the state ballots for any federal office. This is a law that's within the power of Congress to pass. And 9 times, the two-party tyranny has refused to pass this law because they don't want those pesky little Greens and Libertarians and Constitutionalists and Reformers getting power. So we are literally being blocked from public democracy. Just today, a post was made by Berto Youngman. The title of the post is, It's Official. U.S. is an oligarchy controlled by 42 people. And then it has about 6 headlines and the documentation and so forth. So the U.S. government does not represent the U.S. public. It absolutely is not operating on behalf of we the people.
I'm curious, why did you drop out after the 6 weeks? What happened?
Well, first off, Andre Barnett, who ultimately won the nomination of the Reform Party, was vastly superior to me in his cultivation of the grassroots of the Reform Party. And there was no question after 6 weeks that he would get the nomination and I would be a distraction. So out of respect for him, I dropped out. However, I only ran for president for three reasons. The first is I was unemployed and had nothing better to do. The second is that I wanted to put all the good ideas that I had developed over the years working with Jock Gill from Clinton's party, with Michael Cudahy, who was the senior campaign advisor for Barry Goldwater, and with Jim Turner, who was number two to Ralph Nader. I had spent years pulling together the best ideas. And I put all of those ideas in one place, a website called We the People Reform Coalition. It's bigbatusa.org. And those four ideas, the four central ideas, are Electoral Reform Act, a coalition cabinet announced before Election Day, a balanced budget announced before Election Day, and a firm policy of full employment and an elimination of all taxes to be replaced by the automated transaction tax, which would be set by national ballot. Also today, we posted something by Stefan Molyneux called Bitcoin versus Political Power. And this is one of the most brilliant YouTube presentations I've ever seen, because what it basically points out is that when governments can print money, they don't have to ask the people to make choices. They can basically fund wars. Fund the Department of Homeland Security. They can fund FEMA concentration camps and train cars with shackles. They can fund the militarization of the police, which is an absolutely insane path that we're on.
So is this what you mean when you say the truth at any cost lowers all costs? Because you look at what the truth is and you see where the money is being siphoned or funded or wasted or spent, as opposed to leveling the playing field. And how do you get your access to this information? I mean, do you spend all day scouring the internet and certain YouTube segments, or do you have keywords that you search to find this information? How do you get yourself to that deep web?
I collect minds. In fact, I lost my security clearances. I've gotten them back, but I lost them when I declared 7,500 foreign contacts. The small minds in the Defense Office of Hearings and Appeals could not comprehend someone with 7,500 foreign contacts, which is what I do. That was my job. For 20 years, I was a non-official person cultivating foreigners on behalf of the U.S. Special Operations Command and the U.S. government. And I lost my clearances to a system that couldn't understand that I did my job better than anyone else.
Because you were seen as a threat? Is that the time? Is that was the problem?
These people have no clue, okay? I mean, the Department of Homeland Security now is saying that if you believe in the Second Amendment, you're a threat to the United States government. There's even one entry in their book on criteria that says if you've got a bad attitude, you're a threat to the U.S. government. I mean, the insanity of this stuff cannot be overstated. So the core requirement for being and my books are free online, except for this last one. The New Craft of Intelligence, for example, is free online, and there's a chapter called New Rules for the New Craft of Intelligence. Someone else said this better than me. Half of life is showing up. And this is one of the reasons why I really like this YouTube by Eric Liu, because what it boils down to is the people have lost touch with how much power they actually have. If we the people pay attention, there is no reason why we can't push back. In fact, there are a number of towns now that are starting to kick big money out of politics at the local level.
True.
It's a question of organizing. It's a question of deciding that you want to take control of your life and your government and your neighborhood back. So I'm very excited. I mean, right now the internet is chaotic. And as you've pointed out, a lot of it is either censored or it's too much information. We have to get ourselves organized and we have to trust one another. And for example, you could have a local citizens intelligence council, which says we want to get to the bottom of fracking. In New York, this one legal couple went town to town and educated people on fracking, which causes earthquakes and it contaminates aquifers. Mm-hmm. And it got individual local towns to forbid fracking.
That's true. It could definitely mobilize grassroots activists. And I think that's a great point. And where you start to restore the power to people is because they can start to share information like that, organize, get coalitions in place, and then start to push out, well, basically stand up for what they want in their own hometowns. And that's how you become a grassroots activist anyway. It's that we've seen it all over the place. And then you can start to push up what you want. If enough people can start searching things, then you can start to push that up to the top of search engines yourself. If you get a big enough group of people to do it, and bring out, you know, fracking in my hometown and get that to the top of search engines by a big group of people. You can basically do that, do what Google's doing if you have a big enough group of people. Is that what you're saying?
Wait, the bottom line is that the neighborhood level is the level where people are most powerful because you know your neighbors.
Mm.
You share information.
True.
What hasn't been happening is that neighborhoods haven't been paying attention. They haven't been organizing. And I think that's starting to happen now. I'm starting to see a lot more localization. And I believe that localization is going to be the antidote to globalization where corporations and banks rule.
All right. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, Robert David Steele is going to answer more of our questions about open sourcing everything. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.